Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 40 featuring David Prescott. First of a series of talks that we have from Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, which we affectionately call THU. Gina's not with us. She was with us, with me the whole time at THU, but went on a well-deserved vacation because she's been working very hard this year. So Stephen is with us today.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Stephen. So we are going to be talking about David Prescott. What do you know about David Prescott?
He is a visual effects supervisor.
That's right. He used to work at Digital Domain and at DreamWorks. And he's also South African, which is kind of unique as well. There are several South African artists. There's actually a little bit of a South African visual effects filmmaking background that happens. And I've known a lot of them. David's one of the sort of older school ones.
Darren Handler.
Jason Iverson. Yep.
Neil Blomkamp.
Yep.
Who actually worked in a studio in South Africa owned by, who's the actor that
Charlotte
he uses?
Copley?
Charlotte Copley.
Yeah. Was it owned by him?
Yeah, it was his studio.
Okay. But he's like, Neil is also like Canadian South African kind of, right?
I don't know. But he worked for Charlotte. How do I know this? At ICT.
Oh, really?
When we scanned Charlotte for Maleficent.
Oh, right.
He was telling us all about that, and Darren Handler was there, actually. And
yeah.
What's the local dialect? Afrikaans? Is that what it is?
I don't know.
They started speaking that back and forth, and that was
interesting. Well, anyway, I love the story of South Africa. We talk about it with David as well, because he has a love for Africa, and loves a love for wilderness, and a love for visual effects, and a love for Burning Man. He talks about all those things, which is really cool. And like I said, we'll have a series of these talks. One quick announcement. We will be at State of Art in Venice, Italy this week. So our very own Lon Gross will be presenting there. It is a pretty kick-ass presentation. I've been helping him a little bit with it, but he's got some awesome stuff he's going to present. So hopefully we will see you guys there. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
It was, it's pretty cool sharing those. We've already started, by the way.
Oh, we have? Okay, cool. So I wouldn't say anything.
Cheers.
I wouldn't say anything untoward now.
I don't actually do any intros in the podcast. I do the intro before the podcast.
Okay, gotcha.
So that way it's not about telling one who you are, because they'll already know. But yeah, it was a lot of fun last night, swapping some of those old stories. It was just hilarious. I was like, oh my God, I haven't thought about that one. And as you were talking about something, I was remembering a few of those.
Kind of weird. We were speaking on the THU TV thing today.
You did that?
Yeah, you know, there's these anecdotal kind of things that you talk about. And
right.
And you're always kind of wary of, like, it's fun to talk about that with people who are there or a fun experience, but should it be kind of for the masses some info? Because you kind of wonder about, like, you know, there's people involved in stories that have happened in the industry and that, and you don't want them out there with everybody all the time.
I hear you.
So it's a little kind of odd.
Yeah.
The THU thing was it's a little bit of that as well. It's a little kind of anecdotal.
Sure.
Histories of shows. I guess now that the industry is as old as it is, you know, these stories, some of them are like 20 years old now.
I know. And so many stories have been told before, and not necessarily correctly either.
That's true.
Hold on just a second. I'm going to test your mic for a second.
There's always like, what's it? It's kind of that thing of there's always three sides to a story, or three sides to the truth. Yours,
yes.
Mine, and the truth.
Yes.
So therein lies the real history of Hollywood, I guess, somewhere, of the effects industry. It would be kind of fun to have someone go around and dredge up all these kind of stories of legend or whatever it is that are out there, find out what ones are real, what was real, and kind of make some, I don't know, weird looking under the cover at the seedy side.
I know. Well, it was pretty. Well, okay, but you were working at a time of the first generation digital domain, right?
Yeah. So I got there in 95, 96. So it was only a couple of years old, 3-4 years, I guess.
Right.
I was one of the first 100.
One of the first 100 people there.
Employees.
And yeah. how did you come about from South Africa to there?
So I kind of had these two great passions in life. One was Africa and wildlife and that kind of thing. And the other one was film. And I wanted to make film since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And so I went and studied design because I had to kind of convince my parents. There was no way to get into computer graphics. Well, there wasn't computer graphics at that time, but I wanted to do visual effects and stuff like that. I used to read all like the Cinefex magazines my dad would get and that. So then I wanted to get into film and do that, but that didn't exist in South Africa in any which way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So I went and studied design because at least then my parents thought I had a backup plan. And I got into like a little agency and stuff, just working and design. My sister owns an agency.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I managed to find like the one company in South Africa that had a couple of SGI workstations. And I lied my way in to get the job. I told them I knew the DP42, this kind of like a Quantel graphics kind of machine. I told them I knew it, that I'd seen it on demo at a show, and I'd worked out how to use it. And it was a total lie. And I swore to myself that if I got that job, I would never lie about my career again. And I never did. I got the gig, and I never lied about it again. And then I got in there, and they wanted me to paint up some graphics.
But, I mean, how many people do you think lie
on I think their a first lot of gigs, people right? do lie to get in, but I had this like it just wasn't really me, and I didn't want to lie about my talents.
I know.
So I got in, and I spent a weekend trying to do what should have taken like an hour because I mean the concept of what a mat was
right
was foreign to me, and I you know, and you had these buffers, so you would put the image two, and it would disappear, and I thought I'd lost it, and then I'd hit the button swap, and this my old image had come back, and my new one had disappeared, and I didn't even understand the theory of buffering of how we can move stuff. So it was pretty funny. And then I did okay. My mind fortunately works for visual effects and I guess in the right way. So I progressed from there. And then I got the break a couple of years later. I was starting to look at going overseas and wanting to go out to SIGGRAPH to try and find a gig. And we ended up with a commercial where a car has a dust trail.
What year was this problem?
It must have been 93. Okay. And we did this dust trail. And we came up with Side Effect software with a different way of doing dust and doing a circle normal instead of a sphere.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't see the intersection between the spheres. And I was working on it with a couple of guys for Side Effects and that, and they were working with some guys at Digital Domain on the smoke for Apollo 13. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of coming up with the same solution I was. And one thing led to another, and they were like, hey, there's this guy in South Africa who's trying to do this smoke stuff.
So you got introduced to Digital Domain through Side Effects.
Yeah. Oh,
interesting.
Through Janet Fraser introduced me and Mark Alunt. And so I came out to SIGGRAPH, and I kind of, they were kind of Side Effects. I owe a lot to especially Janet and Mark Alunt and those guys because they then introduced me around to all the houses.
Yeah.
So it was like Boss Film at the time, Vision Art. I went up to ILM. I went to a couple of different.
Was DreamQuest around at that point?
No, DreamQuest wasn't later, there yet. Yeah. That was still a while later.
Mm.
So I popped around and I interviewed at a bunch of places and I got a couple of decent offers and I decided to take the Digital Domain thing. It just felt more like me.
Why does it feel like you?
I was young and stupid, I guess. Well, now I'm just old and stupid.
Well, how old were you at Digital Domain? You must have been like...
So I started, I was like 24, 25. The average age of DD was like 25, 26 at the time. It was ridiculous.
Right.
So there was something about that mentality of like, we're all in this together. We're going to go and do something to change the world, this, that, and the other, that I really liked. And I liked... the offer from ILM, I thought the people were fantastic in that. But there was something, and I think moving from South Africa, I kind of also knew I would prefer the weather in Southern California than San Francisco. That was a little bit of it. But I went out for drinks with people from both facilities or from a couple of different facilities, and And I probably made more the decision on each company I was talking to was doing phenomenal work at the time. Everybody was doing great work. It wasn't like, oh, I'll go here because those guys' work is so much better than whatever. Yeah. And it just, the idea of living right by the beach was cool. I came from living inland in South Africa. And so it was more the vibe of the place and the people. I liked the way they I liked the way they recruited me. On paper, I remember putting an application into Disney Imagineering, and the response I got back was that I didn't have like 4 years computer science experience and this, that, and the other. And it was all a very, like, you could see someone had gone through a set of tick boxes and I didn't fill those tick boxes. Right. And so they didn't, so I wasn't up for it. And Digital Domain felt very much like they hired the person as well as their skill set, etc. Mm-hmm. And so I went there, and that was a big part of the reason why I went there. And it was a very much a kind of a lightning strike at the time, I think, the company at that time. It was a very, very unique work atmosphere and a very unique kind of way it came about. And there was a bit of a kind of like the rebels without a cause kind of feel to it, which was positive and negative, I think.
Digital Domain was always, I almost got in fights with people because of that, but it was always just kind of rebellious.
It was,
in a weird way, it's like, I don't know why we even thought about it that way.
I think, you know, there's a lot of people got different ways of where it came up, but it was a little bit of a thumb to other parts of the industry. You know, it was this little independent against some big machines.
Mm-hmm.
And pirate flags and all that kind of stuff. That, you know, but none of that was, people think like, oh, did he set off to be this pirate thing, and they came up, the flag came up organically, and you know, there's a lot of stories about how that comes up, and people just always think it was there. But so with that stuff, yeah, there was the kind of rebellious thing. But if you have a look at a lot of the innovation that came out of the company at that time, people like Doug Robel and many other amazing people, but or Nuke, you know, coming from DD, is DD was pretty well funded initially, and then we went through some tough times, and a lot of the innovation from the company actually came from need for it. There was a lot of research and R&D departments in the industry that were very well funded, but a lot of the really cool techniques and software and that came out of DD were a case of someone didn't have a license for something, so they wrote a compositing tool that became new.
So it wasn't like we were going to be different and special. It was like, it was,
I think the culture to be different and a little rebellious was there, but no, how they approached software and everything was a case of, you know, you sat down and no one had written this or done this before, and that was the industry. Like, you went to work every day scared because you had a job to do, some new fire thing or something, and at that time no one had done it, so you were always, it was like almost every job,
every task was a
brand new thing. No one had rigged clothing properly, or hair flowing was a mission, or anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to work very kind of afraid. I did a lot going in there going like, what the hell am I doing? I'm not clever enough for this. And I wasn't a big, you know, math and science guy. And I was thrown in with people who had like doctorates in mathematics and all this kind of crazy shit.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned, for me, I had to learn how to get the best out of them. Okay. And how to, okay, I don't have this, but that person has that. So if I converse and work with them, then I will get this amazing mathematician to help me on my project and fill in the parts I can't. And
but isn't that kind of cool, especially at that time, that you had, there was so many people that were coming in there, as opposed to, like, you know, there's a lot of schools now out there where you can learn visual effects. Then it was like,
there were no schools.
There was no schools. So everyone was a little bit of a mishmash of whatever.
And that was it as well. And we spoke about this yesterday as well a little bit, that one of the unique things for me that set us apart is we hired some people at DD over the years that were just completely glossed over by everybody else.
Right.
And because they didn't
have... I was one of them, actually.
Right. Yeah. Because they didn't have, like me, you know, they didn't have the computer sciences tick, 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 check, check, check box.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we hired, I remember he started there pretty much the same time as me, Wayne Haag, who became a phenomenal map painter. And the guy was a photographer before and had not done map painting in this, but he had a, you know, he was hired. I had nothing to do with hiring him. But he was hired because, you know, he had a unique eye in his photography, and someone saw that and realized, well, look, he's got the eye. We can teach him how to use Photoshop. That's the easy part.
Yeah,
and the guy became phenomenal. And there's many stories of that. I wonder how many facilities have maybe they probably don't know because it was just a resume that got thrown in the pass file.
Mm-hmm.
But how many people they've missed on, you know, that were just truly phenomenal talent. And we used to call Digital Domain at the time DDU, DD University,
yes,
because it was a great place to learn. I mean, if you were, you know, male and under 30, because it was, must have been a, I often kind of wonder about how horrible it was to be a woman working at that company.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that in a bit, but I remember specifically, because I want to bring it up. It was when I was doing my college applications. And I don't know if it's the same, you know, obviously we have an international audience, but in the United States, the way college applications are is it's a long process to get into colleges, right? Basically, you have to write essays, you have to get letters of recommendations from teachers and peers and stuff like that. You have to show all kinds of high grades, et cetera. So, and they're tough, and some of the schools are extremely hard to get into, very competitive. And I applied to a bunch of really big schools. One of them was a very small school called Amherst University, but it was really small and extremely hard to get into. So I got a lot of rejection letters, a lot. But something specific I remember about the Amherst rejection letter, it was amazing. It basically said, I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to accept you. We would love for you to prove that we made the biggest mistake in our life.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, see, that kind of thing is,
you know what I mean?
That's great, because it's a no, but it's also a kind of like a driving force.
Yeah.
And you know, we all get, I think in this, everybody gets inspired or driven by different things, you know, in times, and I could see that being the kind of thing that would be definitely kind of drive me forward.
I had a smile on my face after reading a rejection letter. You know what I mean? And it's also classy. Super classy.
Yeah, I went back some years. I was about 10 years after I left high school to go and do a presentation there. And it took me all my time to not kind of turn around and flip the bird at my art teacher because she had, you know, told me that I wouldn't, you know, because I had always in high school and that, I was always very much design oriented. I was not as much a fine artist. I loved graphics. I loved typography. I loved airbrushes. I loved that. And so I was always, so all my art in high school was very graphic, and they wanted you to be more of a fine artist. And that just wasn't me. And so I nearly failed art in high school, and yet I got accepted into one of the top art schools in the country.
Right.
Design schools. And I studied design. I did not study fine art at all.
Yep.
And because that's what I did. And it's a very different thing. And I so badly wanted to turn around and tell the kids in school, like, just don't listen to the damn teachers, because they have this other, you know, if I had listened to her, I wouldn't have had a career. I wouldn't have gone to design school. I wouldn't have got my first job at an agency. I wouldn't have, none of it would have happened for me based on an art teacher that I didn't fit her form of what fine art needed to be, because she wanted fine artists. And I've always struggled with that a lot, but I kind of wanted to go back and say, you know, look at the mistake you made. You know, I've done okay for myself. And that's a tough one. And I was never the best designer or artist.
But just a lot has happened to you, and you don't know exactly what's happened to her either. But I think you're right. And the fact is that there's a definition of art that's a little bit skewed sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And even Alex Alvarez's talk that I just listened to today, he talks specifically about that, about fine art versus the art we do, which is very derivative, right?
Yeah, it is.
And so it's really kind of, and we learn from each other. It's very collaborative too, especially in visual effects. Visual effects is probably one of the most collaborative art forms.
Yeah,
you kind of have to, and I think that's a beautiful thing, definitely a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and it falls also into that we mentioned this a little bit on something else did earlier on, and that's one of the things that frustrates me a lot. And I saw it quite a bit at another company I worked at where you couldn't do that position because you're not a creative. And the creative was defined by whether or not you could draw. So you could work in the story department if you drew. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, that, you know, there's a lot of authors out there that probably suck at drawing a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. Stephen King's probably not very good at drawing. I don't know.
Sure.
So, and it was just such a bizarre thing. And coming in an animation facility, it kind of made sense. And I realized how frustrated I got with it. And when I look at creativity, I separate. So if you're a great artist, you know, painting is a technique. It's a technical skill. Mm-hmm. You can be a master at the brush and not be particularly good aesthetically with it or whatnot, right?
Right.
There are guys who are phenomenal freehand typographer painters who will not be great illustrators. And yet they're masters at the brush. Mm-hmm. So that's a technique. But the creativity comes from just, you know, lateral thought, thinking a different way. And so separating aesthetic and design sense or art sense or whatever it may be from creativity, you know, I've often said some of the most creative people I've ever worked with are software engineers.
Yes.
The way they've approached and solved some, you know, I would approach the software department and go, I want to do this thing and I'm trying to do this other thing with particles and I don't know. And they would write some crazy little solution for me. Mm-hmm. And then I would go off and use it. But the way they solved it was phenomenally creative.
Absolutely.
You know? And so I think we often misspeak about what creativity is.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I was a math and art major in college. So my math was very creative. Mm. The way that you solve a problem, there's actually several solutions. And sometimes I kind of could fumble my way to a solution and I would have passed, but it wasn't pretty enough.
Right.
And I wanted a prettier solution. And my inspiration towards pretty, especially in mathematics, is it's kind of like the coding thing, right? Where it's like, how small,
minimal
can I make that solution? And it was really pretty to me and I loved it. And it was, and you know, it's funny, and I can see it whenever you show your teacher your solution, and he's like, this is how I came up, and a smile on everyone's face, like, oh, you know why? Because they saw beauty.
Right.
They saw beauty, and beauty exists in all these little levels and all these things that we do.
Yeah, and people have often asked me, like, what do you feel like helped you in your career more than anything? And I've always said, you know, I'm not the best aesthetic creative, and I'm definitely not the best technically. But I have the ability to think and solve problems laterally. So I'm able to approach a problem from a very, very different aspect, and I call it baking often. I know that if Bob over there has got some cool doohickey he did once on something for some show, and this guy's got another one, and someone else has got this, if we combine them, we could end up with a new solution for a whole new problem that just came up. Mm-hmm. And whereas just getting stuck in that. And so for me, I think that then the ability to converse with programmers and engineers and that kind of thing, and all the way through map painters and whatnot, and be able to get them together ended up being a different skill, I think, for me, and kind of honing that. And I think falling into visual effects is the perfect realm for me. It just worked because you got to play with all these cool toys and things and be creative with it. And, you know, for me, it's like the creative use of technology.
And it is also, as you described, it is a huge place for problem solving. Everything you're doing there is a problem solving problem, right?
Whether it's managing people to trying to figure out why software is not working.
Or the fact that every movie you're doing something that no one's ever seen before. So you always have to come up with, I mean, every project you start, you have an R&D phase, you have a development phase, right? You have to, because you can't just like, all right, start making shots. Like, no, we have to make everything.
Well, that's changing now though, right?
It is
because
changing.
The development process on a show is now more a case of updating your tools and things, techniques and that, and getting it faster, better, quicker. And then you've got development for the look of the film. That's always going to be the case, right? Whether you've got Monster A or Monster B or some, you know, some movie that needs to look like something else. So that'll always be there. But that, you know, we have, you know, whatever, a few hundred shots of smoke to do, and no one's ever done smoke before. That seems to have gone a bit. Right. And so the challenges are different now than what they were.
Right.
And you hear a lot of people kind of our age and that have been in the industry for a while kind of missing that.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I think part of me misses that to a point. But by the same token, I also know that I don't have to be at work for 20 hours because we've got to figure out some new wacky force field thing for a particle to fly through that no one's done before. And so a lot of the time ended up on screen because no one had done it before, but a lot of your time was just figuring out how to move something from here to here, or, you know, why the new version of something broke all the vertices on all the models for the entire show. And that seems to have gone away, which is kind of cool now to me. It's like, that's not what your worry is. Now the worry is trying to make better imagery and be a better filmmaker and partner with people.
Yeah, I think it does help. People are using less and less custom software. They're starting to to phase things out. And they're using, you know, Shotgun. Everyone had their own version of Shotgun.
Whether it was some weird web browser or some text file online somewhere.
And even that, it's like, you know, well, it's like there's pipeline and, you know, it's like, but now even your pipeline is, there's a tool for that for you.
There is. And I think that's where, I think one of the things that I always kind of monitored was like whatever tool for the day.
Sure.
And I had kind of become, you know, oh, you're a Houdini guy. And I'm like, I'm not a Houdini guy. It's just I primarily do all the effects and that kind of stuff. And that was the better tool for the time. But I really didn't care what tool was used
on any given day. I get that. I'm the V-Ray guy. I don't like
and
it.
And it's like, that's just, you know, that's where I spent most of my life.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of work I was, my brain fitted more within. And so the kind of the custom tool was necessary then, because you were writing, you know, your own FluidSim thing, because there wasn't a good enough FluidSim tool out there or decent compositor or whatever. So those exist now. But now what you find is it's more, you know, whenever I hear custom something now, I'm like, oh, the hairs go back. Because it's usually like a more of a proprietary technique than it is technology. There's, you know, and so you hear a lot of these people developing like their own in-house renderers. And you're like, why at this stage of the game are you spending millions and millions of dollars writing a renderer? Why don't you partner with a rendering company or something like that? It just seems as though there is this, still this jaunt to kind of do that. And it's a strange thing.
Some of the big ones, obviously, that if you're is the Hyperion render from Disney, obviously that's a very different
one. And that's,
and then I forgot
for that to come out of a big company like that is that pretty awesome, that because that's usually the big slow boat that won't do something that quickly.
Yeah, and they, considering they also own RenderMan. So.
Well, yeah, but that started during the whole crossover kind of thing.
So, but anyway, it's very interesting because basically that is a completely different way of thinking about rendering in a lot of ways. But it's also not necessarily for everyone. It's a completely different way of thinking about rendering that solves a problem that's related to exactly that they have, that no one else has necessarily.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, again, so I can see that working, but I hear, you know, various companies chat to them and they're like, oh, we're going to write a new renderer. And like, really? But there is in our industry, there's always kind of factions or cliques or whatever. And I always kind of laugh that, or joke, I guess it sounds like I'm laughing at people, but I always kind of joke that rendering is the most zealotous.
It is.
Of all the disciplines within what we do. Modelers will use Maya and be like, oh, cool, I'll go over to Modo. That looks cool. Or I'll try this tool and I'll go to that tool. But lighting and rendering is like, I've seen like...
People will throw shit against the wall because they have to use another
render. Crazy. Yeah. And I've got wrapped up into that as well in the past. And I think I hopefully have outgrown it.
Yeah.
But it is crazy.
And here's the thing, right? And I'm, you know, I work for a renderer and I love my renderer because it's been the thing I've been using for a long time. But the truth of the matter is 2 + 2 = 4.
Right.
And if you put 2 in and you add 2 to it, it'll equals 4 in any render that you use. Right. And the only difference is how easy was it to get there and how fast is
how quick does it come back?
Does it come back?
Yeah.
And that's the only difference.
No, it's all the same math. Anybody can do it. It's not quite
And the cost of a render is minuscule compared to your time and the render time, right?
Right. I see the rendering side of it. And I'm not talking about the lighting and the surfacing and the shader writing. I'm talking about the final cost of rendering.
Yes.
The actual, like, whether it took 3 hours or 10 hours, you know, you want it to be as efficient as possible. But I always think back to something that I was taught when we were working on set, and I was like, wow, we're putting another roll of film in. And somebody, I think it was Eric Nash, that turned around to me and said, film is the cheapest thing on this set.
Right.
And it's like, you can always throw another 400 foot in. Right. That's, yep. You cannot worry about film. So I kind of now equate render times to the same thing.
Mm, right.
Where I'm like, that's the cheapest thing we do. The guy sitting there that we're paying hundreds of dollars.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That guy, that's the time we should be worrying about. But, not the clicked a button, went
but
home.
But if he has to wait for a long time.
Right. So final render, right? So this is now where you get into the, what can we do to get back as fast as possible that I can make an educated guess to click the big red final render button. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy for that to be 40 hours a frame. But I need that to come back very representative of the 1 hour frame you showed earlier. You showed me earlier, you know, if right. And so that's that thing of like, okay, show me a final frame, show me the various stages before then. Okay, yep. You need to show me this and I can now see where it will jump to.
Well, all of that is changing, David.
Yeah, that's changing drastically.
And one is, first of all, there's a lot of times now where people are starting to say 1 hour frame, why is it taking that long? So right. That's starting to happen. And the other thing that's happened, and there's another podcast I did with Kevin Bailey from Atomic Fiction, and he's a, you know, one of the biggest advocate for cloud rendering. So
right.
He scales up small studio, right. Scales up to 10,000, 20,000 PCs in a night without any worries mm-hmm. about it at all. And that and the best thing about it is that it scales down to zero when he's done.
Yeah. And so I get, and that's kind of what I'm saying, is that piece is like the,
yeah.
When you have a look at your hard cost of money going out the door to yep. artists or machines or whatever, and you don't want to, you know, spend off 20,000 render hours overnight just because. I mean, you still sure. got to be responsible.
And you're paying for that somewhere.
Right. Yeah. So I'm not saying be frivolous with it, but if you have a look at where you spend the man hours and the cycles and this, that, and the other, if you can make the previews and everything else better, more representative, faster, and the time at the desk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's for me, it's always been iterative. It's how many iterations can that artist get back?
Yeah, I get it.
And it's not about, for me as a soup, it's not about how many iterations I can necessarily see. I should be able to give direction and say, okay, after you do this and you make that red and then blue, and then we'll be done in two or three versions. We yeah. should be able to get there. It's not like show me stuff. All those, there's always those shots like, I don't know, let's play. I don't know what we're going to do. But if the artist can have the iterations, then the version they can show me is going to be closer to what the original brief was.
Right.
And so I should have to go through less iterations, and the cost of getting me in a room with a bunch of people, etc., is more than that artist at his desk again.
Yes.
So that's where I'm like, render hours should be the least of the concern. It should almost be transparent to artists at this stage of the industry.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree. Definitely don't disagree. I think that there's a lot of interesting thing that's going on in terms of how rendering is going to evolve. There's a lot of stuff that we're mm-hmm. we're considering in terms of where rendering is going to go. We're trying to lead some of that discussion. But yeah. So okay, let's get back on. Kind of went on a tangent there, which
back
is cool. But so you were saying. And we can talk about this briefly, but you were basically at Digital Domain when you were there, and you were saying there was a real kind of like cowboy attitude, frat house attitude,
right? Yeah,
and you were saying you felt really bad for any woman who was going into industry at that time.
It was very frat house kind of guy dude thing, and there weren't many women in the industry for whatever reason. I don't know if a lot of us came from the kind of like guys, geeks with computers kind of realm, and it this country, I've looked at this going back now, it really didn't, there just weren't women going through computer science schools, and they weren't invested in, there was a lot of stereotypes,
mm-hmm.
and it was very much the industry at that time was very much a kind of guys frat house thing, and mm-hmm. I think back now, a little more kind of older and sensitive. I wouldn't say wise. I'm never going to be wise. So just sensitive to it. There are some incidents in that you're like, oh man, that was kind of like out of hand, you know?
Yeah.
And kind of like dude frat boy. And it wasn't just Digital Domain. I mean, I've got friends at other studios that had similar kind of issues.
Yeah, I have very fond memories, but I also feel very guilty.
Yeah.
I feel it. Yeah.
There are some instances where I'm like, yeah, that was kind of sucky, you know?
Yeah. But it was a different time in the industry. And like you were saying, you were, you, average age 24, 25?
So the number I remember when I started Digital Domain, the average age was about 25 or 26
okay.
at that time. And that's crazy young. And you know, the industry was paying, if you had good talent and skills at the time, if you compared our salaries to other industries in that, at that time, we were earning a fortune, you know.
And so we had no sense of responsibility.
No sense of responsibility. Yeah. We were going out, you know, having fun with it and that. But we were also kind of, if you have a look at industries throughout time, the ones that really push it and that is the kind of the freaks, the, you know, the crazy, that makes that happen. You don't win an Oscar in 10 hours a day.
No.
It just doesn't happen. So that is part of it. And a big part of the industry, from film to any creative industry, whether you're in advertising, design, whatever, as soon as you're in some kind of like, should it look red or blue, and this subjective taste that needs to be employed, you know, it's not going to take 5 hours to do it. It's just always going to go up until the last minute, because there's always going to be someone wanting to look better, or, you know, does it, can it be this, will it sell more, whatever, bicycle tires or whatever the hell you're designing.
Yeah.
So the visual effects fits very much into that as well. And then there's also, you know, as a VFX soup, I know a lot of people might disagree with this, but there is also the responsibility as a VFX soup to the budget as well. And, you know, a lot of people, oh, no, it shouldn't be your concern. But I disagree. You know, I'm hired to put good images up. And for a price, though. And so you still have to be beholden to that. And I think that's where, like, having a really good relationship with the producer I'm working with, and having this kind of mutual trust, works really well.
Right.
But there was a lot of kind of cowboy attitude in that as well, which is like, well, we just shouldn't give a damn about the budget. And you're like, no, well, at some place time we have to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's changed now. But a lot of that has also come from studio pressure now.
Yes. Yeah. And they
good and bad.
Yeah. And it's fine. You know, to be honest, when I was bidding and stuff, if I mentioned this before, but I love the creative process of fitting what you need to inside the budget, because sometimes the budget constraint,
right,
can create interesting solutions.
Well, it's kind of innovation through adversity, and that's kind of what I was touching on earlier on. I think a lot of the innovation at Digital Domain came through, we couldn't go out and buy some other new crazy fun thing, and so we built it ourselves.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's how Nuke got evolved, and
stuff like that. And so that kind of thing came from that necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a similar thing now with the industry, and I think that's okay. I think it's more a case of, you know, studios bidding each other against tax subsidies and this, that, and the other that I think has, over the last 5 years, has beaten a lot of companies down and has kind of worn people out.
Yeah.
Is it's not, you know, it's not even doing it for that. It's just, well, we just want it for this number.
Right.
And that's it. So it's a changed industry.
What do you think? What was the story you were telling? Oh, that's right. Yesterday we were talking to Kevin Mack, and we were talking about like on What Dreams May Come, and how you had been so obsessed with the L system.
I was so tired. So Kevin came to me on What Dreams May Come, and we had this really cool sequence with this tree that was going to grow and blossom, and then all the leaves would fall off it, etc. It turned out that it didn't grow. It was a static shot at the end of the day, and we probably could have matte painted it, to be honest, and put particles on. At the end, that's not how it started.
Right.
And so Kevin has always been one for kind of artificial intelligence and using math and science to grow and whatever. So he approached us as a crew and said, you know, how should we do this? And I had always been playing around with just different aspects of prisms at the time. It wasn't even Houdini.
Mm-hmm.
And set off on working with side effects. And even Stephen Regulus from Massive was working with them in a weird way to write this L systems operator based on Linda Meyer's math. And then how to seam it all together and whatever. And so we set off on writing the code for this, and Side Effects wrote it, and I was kind of like the guinea pig. But then I would have to kind of, you know, I studied all of you know, the algorithmic beauty of plants and shells, and I met with Dr. P and all these guys on how to, you know, write the math behind plants.
Right.
Yeah, because I don't think people realize, like, it's basically an interesting, it's a fractal
right, it's system. It's kind of fractal. It's more a kind of cascading repetition, I refer to it. So if you write, you know, branch steps forward, turns left, repeat yeah. branch, you know. And so it's a lot of this kind of turtle geometry that, that kids learn in school. So it's step forward is you know, a letter, let's call it L, and then minus means turn left, and then L means step forward again, right. and little L means half a step, and then right. a branch is a, you know, bracket or whatever. So it's all this very simplistic kind of math. But when you look at, so then you have to look at a tree and you have to look at each tertiary branch and figure out the math. So the math became out of control. And it wasn't just that we needed to make a tree look like a tree. It needed to look like that tree
right.
that they had already painted in the film. So that became infinitely harder and it could right. have probably been modeled.
Yeah.
So with this tree, what ended up happening was we had to match it. So you couldn't just, the rule structure became very complex, and we had right side tree, left side tree, and it was all this kind of plus F minus J bracket forward bracket curly bracket, you know, gravity this, then the other. And so I had got so tired doing it, and the final build of this on prisms on some little workstation basically ran overnight, and we ended up printing out the paper of the final code for it, and we ran it up the wall, across the roof, and down the other wall of the room we were in. That's how much, like, iteration it ended up spitting out. And I think I still have the text file for that.
Wow.
Because I wanted to keep it. But so I had set off the final grow the tree, yeah. like 13 generations or whatever it was. And it was like crazy early hours in the morning. I walked home most of the time. I only lived a couple of miles from work. And I don't know why, but I had the car at work. And so I came out of Digital Domain. I turned left. I turned right. And I got to the street just a couple of blocks away where I had to make a left turn. And I realized I was stuck. I was so tired that I was stuck at the street trying to figure out if I needed to turn minus F or minus L, or should I use backslash and then a gravity vector to turn the steering wheel. I was so tired. I was still thinking in this kind of turtle mathematics. So I parked the car. There's a little laundromat there. I parked the car and I walked home.
Right.
Because I was like, well, if you can't figure out how to turn left,
yeah.
you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I love that story.
That's crazy.
And then did you have an ATM problem or something?
Right. So years before that, when I was in South Africa, we had this job, and we had like less than that. And so we had this job that we used to, before real-time discs and whatever, yep. we had to shoot to a frame store, one frame at a time. And we were rendering the final images to disc and then writing them to frame store, but we were running out of disk space.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't going to be able to put the final render. So what we were doing is we were rendering the final images. I was kind of...
directly to the frame store?
We were rendering to disk.
Mm-hmm.
Then we were shooting it to the frame store, confirm it was on the frame store, and then erasing the final images. And this was crazy, and it was going off to a one-inch tape. And so the constant, I had written a little script, but the command in Unix is kind of df minus k to kind of check for your disk space.
Right.
And a similar kind of thing, was up all night working on this crazy thing. And I went, was driving home, shouldn't have been driving, and stopped at an ATM to get cash.
And you went to see if you had
And I wanted
cash.
To know what I had in my bank account. And I couldn't, because there was no DF minus K, and I couldn't get the ATM to tell me how much money I had in my account. So those are those, like, kind of like, you know, where they say like fatigue can be worse than, you know, being drunk,
yeah.
and it's very, I should not have been driving. And those yeah. are two times in my career where I'm like, wow, that is just
yep.
not right.
I actually know stories of people who got into car accidents because they've yeah. been working too late, you know?
Yeah,
I know,
well,
several of those.
There's one of the guys who worked on Dante's Peak or Titanic. That,
really?
That, well, not at DD, but one of the guys on set that had an accident. It was a big news item at the time.
Mm.
So yeah, it's, and there was a big thing in the ad industry in the Midwest a year or two ago about a similar thing, someone who overworked, overtired, and ended up dying as a
wow.
result. And so, yeah, it's scary. So they're funny stories now,
yeah,
but they're also words of warning,
yeah.
you know, that at some point,
if you find yourself trying to put in code into the ATM machine,
yeah, you might need sleep.
You might need
you
sleep.
Might need sleep. So, yeah. So there's always those kind of wacky stories of what different people went through or,
yeah,
you know, but yeah, those are definitely two times that it was like, okay, this is crazy. This has to stop.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And it got easier after that, you know, once the tool was written and whatever, it was more predictable, because we ended up doing the brain on Fight Club with L Systems as well, where we
where we
grew the brain, the interior of the
Who was the VFX group on? Was it Kevin as well? No,
it was Kevin as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so we just rolled from one on to and just kind of kept on developing that whole thing, and then we turned it into another system. But yeah, so and then that ended up being, I guess, the first CG grown tree in film. So it's kind of like one of those little
This was before there really was that many
there tree systems. There was no tree system at the time. You know, there's been a lot of discussion of what was that was the first attempt in feature film at that, not to put a feather in our cap, but that's how we did it. And then other software companies came along and did the right thing, you know, turned it into usable code and or grew master systems and whatever, and there was some cool stuff in Maya for a while with their paintbrush stuff. And but yeah, that was the first thing. And now looking back at it, if you look at that sequence, you know, because the tree never grew and it didn't do half of what it was supposed to, it just didn't need to be what it was.
Right.
But there's many cases of that in film where you start off because the brief was this and you throw all the bells and whistles in. At the end of the day, it could have been, you know, the old saying of it could have just been a texture map sphere.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so much wasted time. And I think that's another thing to think about. Is there is so much wasted money left on the floor in visual effects because the directors, I'm not like blaming directors, but like the brief was misunderstood, or there wasn't a good brief, or there wasn't a, there wasn't the attention up front. So then what you always get is you get people always kind of protecting themselves and putting everything in case later on you want this thing.
I also think there is this, so here there's a trap. And here's the trap that I believe is there. The trap is that you are you're given a brief, you're given like you just you said, and then the director says something. Now the problem is what he said or she said can be interpreted in many different ways.
Right.
And so the but and then we go into the situation. Okay, now we're going to put in production, and you spend all this money, et cetera, and it's not quite what they wanted, or completely off, or whatever. And then but you. We don't show them stuff early enough to figure out sometimes, or we didn't. We're like, no, we're not going to show the director. Not going to show the director. It's not ready. It's not ready. And there's a legitimate reason for that fear. The reason for that fear is that they look at things and they freak out if you show them too early.
Right. So education, finding the right time. And that's where like working with the director more than once helps a huge amount because you learn each other.
Yeah.
And you learn, you know, there's directors that like, oh my God, we could, even showing final imagery, the notes we were getting back was crazy. So God forbid showing some weird Garot shaded animation test. It just wasn't going to work.
Right.
And I worked on a show like that where our crew was so frustrated with me.
Right.
And the crew wasn't allowed in the meetings with the director. So that was even more bizarre. So they couldn't hear the feedback. And we were having to tell the crew like, no, I'm not kidding. Like the director won't look at that.
Right.
Oh, they should. I'm like, I don't disagree with you. But until we're almost final, fortunately with that director, I was very much on sync with them.
Right.
So there wasn't a huge amount of waste. But that is a very real thing. But then there's other directors. You know, one of the easiest experiences I've had is working with Michael Bay.
Sure.
And a lot of people are like, no way, he's a monster. And the reason is pretty simple is, you know, you don't have to like Michael's movies. I don't particularly care. I'm a visual effects person. I didn't write the script. I do this. I blow stuff up. That's what we do, right? But Michael knows what he wants. And the brief is very clear. It's very concise. And most people, I think artists that I've worked with on the shows got frustrated because they wanted it to be something else. And you're like, no, this is his genre. This is Americana. This is what it is. We need to deliver that. And if we deliver that, it will be finaled. And so I found that oddly refreshing from you got a brief,
right.
You delivered that back, you put a couple of extra explosions in it, and off you went.
Right.
But I actually found working with him very refreshing because his briefs were concise, he knew what he wanted, and if you delivered that, there were very, very few changes. And so you could slot in with that. And there was very much like, I don't know, just show me something. And so I actually ended up, after Transformers, wanting to work with him again. And I've thought about kind of wanting to reach out and do it again because I really liked that experience of it being a, and I could, we could throw ideas back and we were told if he didn't like them in no uncertain terms or not. But there was a creative collaboration in that, and people are often surprised by that with him.
Right.
And often in visual effects, the harder directors to work with, or the first time, not first time director, but first time with big visual effects films.
Right.
Because visual effects are a huge part of their budget.
Yeah.
It's a huge part of their budget, and it's a scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, early on, making sure there's a partnership between the VFX team and the director, knowing that they have a partner and that they'll walk them through this, is critical, I think.
Right.
And it's not easy to get right, because it's also personalities, and there's a lot that goes into making it work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, I don't know, there's something interesting about the whole process of the relationship that you have with directors, right? Because mm-hmm. the longer you work with them, the more you speak a common language.
Yeah, it becomes a shorthand. And that's the case with anyone you work with.
Sure.
You know, if you work with your similar team, you know, you can shorthand stuff.
Yeah.
And that helps a huge amount.
Yeah. And it's funny because, I was at a point when, at one point, there was a director, this is doing commercials, and he was doing all those Scion spots. Remember when they were doing all the cool graphic designy Scion spot stuff?
Yeah.
And he was a very creative person, and mostly worked with graphic design companies to make those. But then he wanted to do a super realistic photoreal car and still have all that stuff.
Oh, right.
And so he got involved with us. This is when I was at Method, and I had a core team of people that I really trusted over there that could do this stuff. And we came from another company, did a bunch of car stuff. But he gave us like this small regional spot for us to do.
Right.
And we did it on like a shoestring budget. But he wrote us hard on it, really hard. And then I realized that was him seeing if we could develop a language together.
Yeah.
And then the next thing he did is like, all right, now you're getting a major national spot. And we did a huge amount of work on it.
Yeah, and that's a smart director from that side of developing it that way around. And I think, you know, in commercials and that, it becomes not, I'm not trivializing commercials in any way, but the schedule is a lot shorter than features. And so being able to figure out, you know, the director and who you work with and who you kind of team up with, it's a little easier when you're in for, you know, a year half feature project.
Yeah.
You've got to make sure that relationship is out. You know, if you're on and off in 8 weeks, even as a studio, you cannot lose that director by saying, hey, so you worked with Bob. You know, it went well. It's good. It works good. But you know what? Now that we've seen you guys work together, we think Mike is a better fit for you. So now Mike's going to be your guy. And then you'll find out that relationship goes on for 10 years. You know? And so it's a little easier because you don't have this like, oh, we've got so-and-so on and we've got 18 months to go.
Right.
And it's not really gelling. So that initial meeting with directors is...
It's very important.
It's as much as...
It's like you guys are dating, moving. Yeah, you're moving in together.
Yeah. It is.
it's more than dating.
There's, you know, you've got to understand that... You make the point that you get their script, you get what they're doing, what you can bring to the table as a filmmaker, et cetera, et cetera. But also, are you going to get on, you know, because you're going to be spending a bunch of time together.
Yeah.
And it's different as to whether, you know, you're the show soup or you're a studio soup and all the different kind of flavors.
Well, that's interesting. So we happen to be doing this podcast before you're doing your talk, but your talk will be... When we broadcast this, it'll be out after your talk.
Right.
So, will you be able to give me a preview of some of the things that you're going to be talking
about?
Don't spoil it too much.
No, so I'm talking about this thing. The title, I forget what the title is now. It's Perception, Problem Solving, and Finding Inspiration in the Default World. It's a big number. So, at the end of every show I've ever worked on, I've taken whatever frustrated me the most about the show, and I've tried to fix it for the next show. So whether it was editorial pipeline or whatever, if it drove me nuts, I didn't want that to frustrate me again, because it's kind of like the definition of insanity. If you keep trying to do the same thing over and over again without changing the way you're doing it, you know, you're never going to change it. So I finished a project and I was very frustrated partway through the project when I would go to artists and I would say to them, we need to look into... I don't know, water or sand or whatever it may be. And because we've got this big project and we've got all this stuff, and I would come back a few days later and meet with the team, and all they had done is gone to Google and Googled YouTube videos and images. And I'm like, but did you go to the beach? Did you go, like, what? And it was just, and that's become the instant internet you know, it's easy. We just search for reference right. on there and what someone else has done. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to see what someone else has done. I want to see what you're going to do with it. And it kind of became this frustration. And I realized that people just never left their desk anymore. Mm. And I'm not just talking at work. I'm talking at home and nope. experience and this whole thing.
Whip out their phone.
Yeah. So the perception side of it is, you know, we're paid as visual effects soups, artists, etc., for our perception. So okay, yes, it's a huge amount of what we do. And part of the example of that is in this talk is if you have a look at one of the things that hit me in my career is if you have a look at the Statue of Liberty, you ask anybody, they say it's green. If you ask them what color is it at night, they say it's green. And it's not, it's blue because of the lights. Well, now it's green because they changed the color of the lights because of this. So when we did X-Men, we went out and we filmed the Statue of Liberty at night for the night scenes. And we put it up as blue because that was correct, right?
Right.
And we looked at it and we're all like, it just looks wrong. Why does it look wrong? It's right. And we're like, oh my God, everybody thinks it should be green. So we ended up changing the color of the Statue of Liberty in X-Men to green at night, even though it's not was not at that time. I believe they've changed the light since then. It was not technically correct, but it was what everybody perceived the statue to be.
Right.
So to make it look photoreal, be perceived as photoreal, we actually had to change the color at night to what people would perceive it to be.
Right.
So there's a section on perception, and part of what we get paid for is how we perceive it, and we have to train our eyes, we have to train our brains to see stuff the way other people. And then the problem solving is a little bit of kind of how we've discussed. It's just different ways to solve problems. It's just different ways that have worked for me. Doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Sure. But and then the final thing is more of a call to arms of as an industry. And it's going to be interesting. I've done this talk once before. It'll be interesting because at this conference, at the Trojan Horse thing, it's there's people who already stepped outside the box a lot more than where I gave this talk before. So I've actually kind of tweaked it. But the call to arms is about get up, get out, and go and experience the world and find experiences that will enrich you, change you, and you'll take it back to work. And maybe in 3 years' time, something will happen. You'll be like, oh, man, I saw this crazy thing at this weird festival in Portugal, and we could use that as reference. And it's not on Google because it's a unique experience. And so we talk a little bit because of this conference, they call it kind of like TED meets Burning Man, about where I found inspiration of Burning Man from the amazing art and just the culture and this kind of get out there and do something. And I recently, while I was coming up with this talk, I was like, I'd looked before to see if there'd ever been research done into this. And I couldn't really find anything. And now there's a paper that was just released last year, medical journal research on how experience is better for you than purchasing material things, and how going out and spending money on travel will enrich in your life, and why, and how it affects your brain and your psyche and what it adds to you and that. And so I include a little bit of these guys' research, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the call to arms is really just about like get up and get out and go and do things to inspire people. And and you know, if you're an artist, it's not just about you. Go out and do things, experience the world a different way, and bring that to the industry and to the creative arts and media. So that's kind of what the talk is about.
Doesn't Pixar do that a lot? Like when they're doing, like, as I remember hearing last year, I think it was at THU, they were talking specifically about, so we're going to do Ratatouille, so we had a huge amount of cooking classes.
Right.
And they experience that, they understand
it. And so that's that aimed at that film.
Right.
Right. What I'm talking about, and that happens to a point. We did that at DreamWorks, did it at DD a little bit. But I'm talking about not, here we've got a movie about cooking, so we should all take cooking classes.
Well, sure.
I'm talking about just in general, just getting up and getting out and going and experiencing this. And it is very much along those lines of get up and get out. The first thing shouldn't be, let me Google it. It should be, do I know anyone with experience of that I can go and have a coffee with and chat to, and then we'll Google and, you know, do kind of web search this whole thing. So yeah, it is a bit of that. It's find other ways to kind of go out and experience this with your team or your crew or something, and go and experience these weird and wacky things that are out there on the planet. And you'll have also just a richer life. I think It's everything is so instant and it's so there right now, whether it's on your phone or whatever, that we just forget to get up and get out. And so it had frustrated me a little bit on the show I was on. And at the end of it, I was asked to go and do a talk somewhere, and they asked me to do two talks, and one was kind of free form. And so that's kind of how it came up. So that's kind of what the talk is about. It's kind of freaky. Sorry, the wind's blowing, and this chair is just kind of like moving along the patio outside. Sorry about
that.
Wow. I was like, ghost.
I was wondering what that noise was.
Poltergeist.
I hear the wind howling behind me. Yeah. It's pretty funny. So that's that's good.
So that's what the talk's about. But now you're not allowed to do that until I've done the talk.
Yeah, I know. So. Well, it'll be good. And if people want to see the talk, they would be able. Actually, they are going to be able to probably see it on THU TV. So.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. And now it also means you've got to behave when you do the talk, because you often do these talks at these conferences, and you know no one's ever going to see it, so you can kind of be a little bit more free form.
But you've got some good stories. You have to behave. Give me a juicy one for the podcast.
I've got no juicy stories.
Oh, are you kidding me?
No, I'm not going to air dirty laundry. No. Told you about being super tired and crazy things.
No. I'm not talking about air dirty laundry. I'm talking about some crazy stuff that happened at ED. We were both working on Day After Tomorrow at that time.
A tough show, yeah.
It was a really tough show, and a lot of stuff happened. But there was a lot of really cool... Now, here's what I'm going to tell you. I'm not airing dirty laundry. Here's one of the things I remember about that show, and this is speaking from someone who was not... dealing with the toughness. I was aware that it was there. I was communicated about it, but I certainly didn't deal it.
Yeah.
You guys, as leads, you were the supervisors and leads, were completely protecting us from a lot of that.
Yeah.
And we basically felt like we were just moving along. Yes, it's frustrating when you have to, you know, do a bunch of turntables.
Number 47 of a hailstone.
47 turntables of a hailstone.
I think it was more than that.
I think there were 4K texture maps for a tongue on a bird.
It was crazy.
And the bird was a background.
So there are shows that just run rampant and get out of control.
But we did have a lot of fun. It was a lot of the, you know, like the frat boy attitude a little bit, but it was.
Yeah, that's the one time where I actually felt that helped, because the kind of the party atmosphere and that helped us build a team spirit.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, we had a tough week, so let's all go get drunk together. And there was a little bit of that kind of band of brothers kind of feel about it. And I think it did help on that show in a unique way.
What was interesting is that it went from, you know, it started off, the martini night started off with like 3 or 4 guys at Rocco's desk.
Right, that's it. Yeah, so they started shaking a martini shaker.
Because I was upstairs.
And it became known as the Martini Cartel.
Yes.
Is what it eventually became. And they would just kind of shaker this martini shaker over the speaker at 7 o'clock on a Friday night. And you knew to go past Rocco or Brandon or one of the guys' desks, and you could have a martini.
Yeah.
And one Friday night, I had become known at DD as the guy who would light various things on fire with Zambuca. So one night we were playing this ridiculous game of you would set your finger on fire called Pass the Flag, and you would pass the flame to the next person and pass it round. And we inadvertently lit our client's hair on fire. It wasn't me who did it, but I was right there.
You started it.
Yeah, so...
Who started the fire?
It was very unfortunate and sadly foretelling of how things were going to go.
Yeah.
That was just out of control. But yeah, it was a tough show. And the protecting artist thing is a tough one, because you... Not just that show, but in general, as a super, as a lead, you want your crew to know what's going on, but you also don't want them to be worried about the nitty-gritty, because they shouldn't. So it's a little bit of a kind of weird parenting thing.
Right.
But there also comes a time where you're shielding stuff to a point, and this happened on that show in particular, where the crew started to realize they knew what was going on, and you weren't admitting it to the crew.
Yes.
And then you run the risk of losing your own crew.
Because they don't trust you.
Right, because, well, you're telling us it's okay, but we know it's not, or whatever it may be. So at that point, you kind of have to make this decision. Now do you kind of sit down with your crew and have what I call a big boy talk? So let's all sit down and put our big pants on and have a conversation about what's really going on. Now get back to work. And it's a very tough thing, because you don't want anybody to – you've got to do it diplomatically. You don't want to say bad things about your client or this, that, the other. But the crew's figured out that something's up. Mm-hmm. And you need to talk to them and say, hey, this is up. This is what we're doing to deal with it and move forward. And but you still kind of want to shield them from the nitty-gritty and the details because they don't need to know. It doesn't help. It doesn't help the show. It just creates bad morale.
Yep.
And so that's those kinds of instances are very, very, very hard to navigate. And,
right.
you know, there is no formula for that stuff. And you've also got a bunch of artists and computer geeks and whatnot trying to navigate those waters together. It's not trivial. I mean, I have a friend who she consults all over the world with, you know, giving companies advice on conflict and how to deal with, like, you know, billion-dollar conflict in oil companies and stuff like that.
Right.
And it's non-trivial. And now you've got a bunch of, you know, geeks and artists trying to navigate those waters where some of the top, you know,
right.
minds in the world yep. struggle with that. So and you've got passion and you've got artists and
yep.
stuff like that. So those things, that kind of protecting your crew to a point is, it's a tough one to do. And it's yeah. a tough one to do right. And I don't know that, in all fairness, as big a nightmare as that show was, I don't know that anybody on either side of the fence got it right, to right. be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, in the end, I really appreciated it. I'll tell you this as a person. I knew enough that I didn't feel like I was being lied to.
Right.
But I also knew enough
that you didn't want to know anymore.
to me, a little bit, and the fact that you guys are okay and sort of laughing it off because you had no choice. But as part of me was saying, like, it was kind of like watching it like a TV show. You know,
it
like,
was.
Look what's going
on. Afterwards, we were like, we said that we should have filmed some of those things. As
it
episodes,
would have been one of the best reality shows
yeah,
ever.
The four kind of CG DFX suits would sit in this office together and we would close the door and be like, okay, so what are you doing about that? Or what are you doing about this? And I think it was Sean Faden that one day started playing Barbara Streisand's Send in the Clowns, which is one of the most depressing songs you've ever heard. And it kind of became the four of us. It kind of became our little theme song. It's like, Send in the Clowns. And it just became this really depressing thing. And we would never let the crew know that that's kind of really how we felt.
Like you basically, like, you had to close the door, put on Barbara Streisand, and start crying in a huddle together.
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden someone knocks, like, quick, turn it up.
I forget who originally, I think it may have been Sean who came in one day just kind of humming it. And somebody picked up on it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Andy was so amazing.
Yeah,
he was so amazing. Still. And
the worst you ever heard from Andy was like, "Oh, he's a knucklehead." Like that's like if Andy called someone a knucklehead. Wow, Andy's angry.
You know? I really miss him. So I'd really love to get in touch with him again. Yeah, so you should definitely.
He'd be a good person to talk to.
And I was telling the story. I mean, it's just kind of one of those things with the perception of hire. So go back to what we were saying before. It was Andy who basically saw the potential that I had, you know, when they hired me. And, you know, one of my particular manager at the time when he interviewed me, he was asking me very standard blah questions, you know. Melanie didn't, who was the person I had worked most directly under, she didn't really ask me many questions, although she's an awesome, awesome person. But Andy was the one who said, "No, I see a chance in this person. I know that he can do it." And I didn't have all the check boxes, you know. I didn't.
And that was very much, we mentioned that. That's very much the DD kind of mentality. Yeah. It's like, "Oh, we'll take a chance."
Yeah. And all those chances proved amazing. A lot of them are really, really good. Like you were talking about Rio the other day.
Yeah, Rio is an intern that Scott had somehow brought out from Japan for something, and he was assigned to me on X-Men to pretty much like keep me fed, keep me caffeinated, and keep me going.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a little personal assistant, right?
And we found out that he like wanted to write shaders, and we're like, "Oh, well, here's the Render Man book. Go ahead and try and write a shader." And like 2 days later, the shader he wrote is the one we used and finaled in the movie. And I was like, "Well, no, you can't be my assistant. We need people on the box. Off you go." And we assign him to a really seasoned professional, Garmin, and Garmin kind of became his journeyman.
Oh, Garmin,
and this young kid just cranked out the most amazing work, and he ended up being one of the guys involved in the volumetric rendering tools that won a SciTech award.
Yep.
And so from this young kid that was like some wacky little intern to, and not long, I think that was within like 3 or 4 years, he was involved in that. So
right.
super, super talented kind of beast. Yeah. And so there was a lot of that, and there's a lot that went wrong, you know.
Sure. Yeah, there's always things that go wrong, but it was an interesting experience, and I think that the agenda that was had at that time was a lot of fun. And like I said, I remember them fondly, even though there was lots of weird things that happened.
Yeah.
And it is part of my education, right? It is part of my experience.
My father said to me once, I was back in South Africa visiting, and I was describing a tough show or something, and I was saying, oh, you know, it's terrible and I didn't learn anything. And he's like, no, he's like, you learn stuff. Sometimes you just learn things you don't particularly want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that really resonated with me. And since then, I have looked at shows like those, and I've learned huge amounts about how to manage people, how to deal with this, how to deal with tough client, whatever it may be. So they have benefited my career later on. If you're not going to kind of stick your heel in the ground and refuse to learn from something, then even the tough experiences can be really beneficial. You know, if you're kind of open to kind of being honest with yourself, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great advice. And at that point, I think we're going to end our podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
That's been cool.
Yeah. So what I usually do is I say we're going to let the last bucket drop, because that's what we do when we end the rendering.
That's true.
and anyway, I really appreciate it. It's awesome hanging out with you. And now that you're kind of in LA,
in
LA.
Yeah, back in LA. Yeah.
All right. Well, then we should definitely hang out more.
Yep.
That sounds great. All right. Cool. Take care. Bye.
Thank you.